GBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a civic media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Ghislaine Maxwell, the former girlfriend and convicted co-conspirator of sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, may be questioned about the so-called client list.
The deputy attorney general says he plans to meet with Ghislaine Maxwell soon. In a statement, her attorney saying they are, quote, grateful to President Trump for his commitment to uncovering the truth in this case. And we should note she's appealed her 20-year sentence and is eager to get out of prison.
ABC's Mary Bruce. The 29-year-old man prosecutors say injured dozens of people when his car slammed into a crowd outside an L.A. nightclub over the weekend, charged with 37 counts of attempted murder, 37 counts of assault with a deadly weapon. The U.S. and Olympic Paralympic Committee effectively banning transgender women from competing in women's sports, citing a, quote, obligation to comply with an executive order from President Trump. Rocker Ozzy Osbourne, the Black Sabbath frontman, and a decades-long solo career. He died after battling Parkinson's, 67. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
A shutout in Seattle. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball. The Brewers with a 6-0 shutout win over the Seattle Mariners. The crew held hitless until the top of the sixth when Joey Ortiz got on base, then slid into home plate. FanDuel, Wisconsin.
Contreras, a high fly into right. Ortiz back to tag. Canzone under it, makes the catch. Here's the throw home. Ortiz slides. He's safe. 1-0 Brewers on the sack fly by Contreras.
Ortiz kicking off a four-run inning. Pat Murphy.
Then Terang, and then Contreras sack, and then Yelly base hit, and then Churio missile, and Collins walk. I mean, that's seven quality at-bats in a row. That's what you have to do. You got to stack them. That's how you get crooked numbers, if you stack them. And yeah.
So for now, Milwaukee has the best win-loss record in baseball and one game ahead of the Cubs. They lost 12-4 to the Royals at Wrigley Field. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
A game without a crowd is just a scrimmage. A performance without an audience is just a rehearsal. Without your presence, high school sports and the performing arts aren't possible. Ensure that these essential extracurricular activities continue to enrich the lives of students in Wisconsin. Purchase a ticket to your local high school's game or performance.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Tom Hartman here. You're listening to 97.9 WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Oh, the joy, the fun, the chaos. Trump posted a fake video of Obama getting arrested. That's newsworthy. The U.S., evidently, we're going to stop assessing fairness of elections around the world. According to our Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, he's ordered the State Department to stop commenting on the fairness, integrity, and legitimacy of foreign elections. Because, hey, look at ours. Look at what's happened in the era of Trump. And, oh, by the way, if you want to come to the U.S., if you're going to travel to the U.S. from anywhere around the world, expect to pay a $250 visa integrity fee because, yeah, so much for giving us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses that we're trying to round up and put into alligator Alcatraz. Never mind. And oh, by the way, since the Wall Street Journal had the audacity to report on Trump's involvement with the Epstein thing and print a letter that he may have written, or they believe he has absolutely written, and I got to tell you, I'm not quite sure he didn't. They are no longer allowed, evidently, to cover the president's weekend trip to Scotland. That's done, and I got to assume that they're going to be out completely from the press pool at some point. Now, again, they can work their way back in by writing a loyalty pledge to of their favorite Trump executive order. And the other big news, Thank goodness for Donald. Sports teams' names are back. Never mind the price of eggs. Never mind your rent. Never mind the price of gas. Never mind any of that stuff. Never mind that your check, your paycheck is disappearing before you can even blink. The real crisis in Trump world, what we call the Washington football team and the Cleveland baseball team. That's important. Because, of course, working families are losing sleep over that issue. Not layoffs, not health care, not another round of billionaire tax cuts. Nope. The name of the Washington football team, that's going to make or break the country. And what it is it's classic Trumpism. Fight over something totally tribal, throw the red meat in for the culture war crowd, and maybe, just maybe, the rest of us won't realize that he's got a trail of broken promises and corporate giveaways a mile long. And the stadium deal that he may want to block because of the name, not a single peep about the workers who would be building the stadium or the communities are going to be displaced because of gentrification or the screw job that most stadiums are for taxpayers. No, it's the name. And look, it's all performative. It's the MAGA magic trick. Hey, look at the mascot. Don't look at the mess that I've made. And none of this really helps working people. Not you, not me, not anyone. Not anyone who works for a living, whose back hurts at the end of the day, who actually did an honest day's work. No. It's all about stirring the pot, keeping people all at each other and arguing over dumb stuff. Forget your kid's school can't afford books. Forget your job has no benefits. Forget the fact that we've just made the billionaire class even richer. Never mind. Congratulations, Donnie. You did it again. Thanks for reminding us what real working families care about. You know, not the real problems that they're drowning in, but the tough stuff. You know, like nostalgia for an offensive team name. And the thing is Democrats have a chance here. This does not play well in working class circles. There's a chance for Democrats to actually do something and get a message. The folks over at Lake Research, they did a presentation recently. And you know what the top issues that people cared about? Top priorities? Expanding health care, affordable health insurance, taxing the uber wealthy, and eliminating junk fees that we get killed with every single time we purchase something. It's the economy, stupid. Whereas Trump world, it's about the division. It's about the divide and conquer. It's the I could pay half the working class to murder the other half. Democrats need to find their message and hit on all cylinders. Because at the end of the week, when the paycheck doesn't go far enough, that's what matters. Not what we call my favorite baseball team. I grew up a Cleveland Indians fan. They're the Cleveland Guardians. Don't care. That simple. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Is this the issue? Is this the big issue? Is this the one that's going to solve our debt problems? Is this the one that's going to bring childhood poverty under control? Not thinking. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back with Alex Lawson from Social Security Works.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the Congressional Budget Office has come out with a new report. Politico reported on this yesterday, said that the big ugly bill that Trump signed on the 4th of July going to increase our deficit by about $3.4 trillion over the next decade, and about 10 million people are going to lose their health insurance. Yeah, because that's what it's supposed to do. And here to talk about the effects of the big ugly bill and what it's going to mean for healthcare, not just in your backyard, but all across the country. I've asked my good friend Alex Lawson to come share some thoughts. Alex is the executive director of Social Security Works. You can check out their website at socialsecurityworks.org. Alex, thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure to be here, even when we're talking about sad stuff, infuriating stuff.
So remember, this was supposed to save us money. We were supposed to fix the debt, fix our deficits. We were supposed to save money. It was supposed to get everybody. This was supposed to be everything to everyone, unicorns, rainbows, and cotton candy for everyone.
Yeah, and they were going to release the Epstein list too, right? Well, lies. All of it's lies. It's even worse. It is 10 million. That's what the CBO report is talking about for one component of this bill. But there's always two components. The other one is in the Obamacare side, and you add them together. So now it's 15 million people lose their health care. And if you just remember back to last time we were talking, I was hammering 17 million. And so there will be sort of Republicans and these right wingers being like, oh, what happened? What's wrong? Your numbers, we went from 17 to 15. And you're like, you tried to cut 17. That's what they wanted to do. They were prevented from cutting 17. And the CBO just gave us the final number of what they were able to actually get across the finish line. And it's a absolute apocalyptic crushing of American healthcare, of the entire health system. 15 million people lose their health insurance, right? I mean, it's a mind-boggling number, but policy is, you know, predictable. You actually do know what happens when that happens. People die. People get hurt. They are harmed and they die. That's what's going to happen. Hospitals across this country are going to close at levels we've never seen before in this country, ever. Yeah. Nursing homes across this country are gonna close. These are skilled nursing facilities. We oftentimes just call them nursing homes. It's like a fine way of sort of thinking about them. But really what it is a skilled nursing facility for places where people need some in-depth level of skilled nursing, integral part of our health system. It's not like an afterthought. And so decimating hospitals and nursing homes across the country, it will be so bad. I don't know how.
Oh, come on, Alex. We've heard you talk about the skies falling before. You know, we've heard all this before.
It's true, but we always won before. That's I do hear this, Rick. I do. I know you do too.
And it's a testament to the work that you guys do at Social Security Works, because they've been trying to do this for decades. This isn't new. This is the first time that they've really succeeded, because they're cutting almost $1 trillion in healthcare spending.
That's exactly right. I actually. Because it's a demoralizing time. So we need to like focus in and come up with plans, and I'm looking at what we've done before, what worked. And I was actually looking at me on television from Trump 1.0 fighting against, it was almost identical. And, you know, we won that one. But just remembering that we won, it was because people raised their voices. We brought so much heat. But at the same time, I mean, it really was John McCain was faced with his imminent mortality. He knew he was going to die from an aggressive brain cancer. And, you know, whatever part that played, for whatever reason, he gave that thumbs down. And that's the only reason that they didn't get this in Trump 1.0. That's why all that bad stuff didn't happen. But now they've got it. And it's so important to really dig into, like, they say savings or whatever. Like, what? Who is saving? And what does it mean to bring $1 trillion to just suck that out of a system? Like, it was there, and now it will not be there anymore.
Right. And the reason I asked you to come on is because on your Facebook page, you shared two maps that I thought were really, really telling in what happened under NAFTA and what probably is going to happen to this country once we got $1 trillion. And the map here on the screen is, you know, in 1990, the country was a manufacturing country. You know, a lot of places were heavy in manufacturing. It was the number one job creator. And then, you know, after NAFTA, well, that all went away, and healthcare has kind of taken up that slack. People went into getting healthcare jobs because, hey, we're going to always need nurses. And now that we're gutting funding from that, what do you see as the outcome then?
So, and it's important to remember when they what they did when they sold NAFTA, right? They said that this was going to create jobs. It was going to be good for the economy. This was saving things, right? And like, no, this was just transferring wealth from working people up to the bosses, to the billionaire class. That's what NAFTA was. That's exactly what this is. But so much of our economy is actually now based on healthcare that people will die. That's for sure. It's like for sure. 15 million people losing their healthcare, tens of thousands will die. But also, I think, and, you know, this is being talked about. That's a New York Times graphic, and there's health newsletters. I think Scott Galloway's is where I saw that. And so it's not like just me saying this. It's we have to look at the devastation to America that the loss of manufacturing jobs led to understand what the loss of healthcare jobs when you cut $1 trillion out of the system is going to look like. And I think anecdotally, you know, I've driven all over this country talking to people, trying to be like, the billionaires are the problem.
Duh.
I've seen it where a hospital is the main focal point. It's the only thing sort of like left in a local rural economy. And, you know, there's a lot of jobs associated with it, but the hospital in a lot of places is not just the place you go when you break your arm. It's also the largest employer, which means it's the largest provider of insurance, which means it's this deeply stabilizing entity, right? The way that a factory used to be, and towns were built around a factory because there were the jobs in the factory, but then everything that came with that, which created places, right? And what we saw was, and I'd love to hear you talk about it more, educate me, but I mean, like, you removed the factory and whole swaths of the country just sort of disappeared. And I've driven through those areas, and it's devastated parts of America. And unfortunately, like, that's where a lot of MAGA really lives.
No, and
it's been hollowed out.
Absolutely. And this is where I go back to the 2016 election. And I was saying all along, when I went back in April of 16, when my grandmother passed, for the funeral, you know, my family, otherwise known as the basket of deplorables, they were enthusiastically supporting Trump. These are people who had never voted ever. They were never politically active, never bothered to vote. It was never a thing. But these were people who they were all in on Trump, not because they were racist and homophobic and misogynistic. They're all those things, but that never motivated them to vote before. What motivated them to vote was he told them he was bringing back Brook Park Avenue. And in Cleveland, anybody who knows the west side of Cleveland, Brook Park Avenue is where Ford was on one end, Chevy was on the other, and everywhere in between were hundreds of feeder factories that fed both of those behemoths. All those jobs are gone now. Those factories are idled. They're falling down. Those jobs are gone. The standard of living that those jobs afforded people, all gone. And what's happened since NAFTA, you lost that standard of living, that thought that if I work hard and play by the rules, I'm going to get ahead. And look, a lot of people in 2022, we drove across country and talked to people. Same thing. Every community lost their manufacturing base. And the map we just showed bears that out. And unfortunately, what replaced most of those good-paying union manufacturing jobs were low-paying retail jobs, low-paying healthcare jobs. Now that those jobs are starting to come up in pay, now we're going to destroy them?
I mean, that's exactly it. That's it. Now that the jobs are good-paying, that's what the billionaires can't really make money when the workers are making money. So what the billionaires and the tech broligarchy, you know, they wrote it down. They thought they came up with it like Elon Musk does all the time. But like their dark enlightenment stuff where they're like painting their spooky vision of the future. Right. And they're like, look at what we came up with. Like, that's the oldest idea ever. Are you kidding me? Like, that's what the robber barons, they wrote it down. You can read Carnegie, right? Like, the Carnegie method that the whole U.S. hyper-capitalism is built on is you always cut costs, which means take it out of the workers. That's why when you, if a share price is doing poorly, like, what does the CEO do?
Concessions.
Fire workers, immediately stock price goes up, right? Because if you take it out of workers, of the people, it goes into the pockets of the billionaires. The big ugly bill is just that at a scale that we've never, I don't think.
Not in my lifetime.
I've had this debate, like when you put it all together, I don't think we've seen anything even like close to how big the cuts are. $1 trillion. Like, the problem is that's really hard to know, like, what does that mean? But like hundreds of hospitals, right? Like hundreds of hospitals. And think of hospitals, how they can anchor an entire county location.
Yep.
All of them gone. And then those towns slowly dying. And you know, this is also on the backdrop of literally everything else that's going on. So it's going to be absolutely devastating. And the point you made is something that I do hear. You know, oh, well, you've said this before. I don't think it's going to be so bad. And I think I've told you this before. The lobbyists for the hospital industry are the ones who are most scared right now in Washington, D.C. They were like really sure that they're, because they're big, big, big business. You know, that's
$1 trillion, man.
Exactly. They always thought, though, because they're consolidating their private equity, they're Wall Street bros. So they always thought they were in the club. Like, I felt this throughout the big, ugly bill debate that they were like, well, someone's going to save us, right? Like, they can't actually do this because hospitals are going to collapse across the country. And then I was like, yeah, they're absolutely, they're going to do it. And I will say hospitals didn't, like AHA, which is the more corporate entity, the association, they did not fight against this bill as hard as they could have. They did not run ads, you know, and what we heard is because they did not believe that the Republicans would actually do it.
Yep.
Because the consequences are so devastating that no one would be stupid enough to cut that deep.
Here we are. Here we are. And the weird thing is I've had working people who have drunk the Kool-Aid, who have told me this is actually going to be a good thing because we're going to trim the fat. We're going to lower the prices of healthcare because hospitals to compete are going to have to. Wages for those high-priced nurses are going to come down. I've had people tell me this stuff, and I'm going, in what world do you think that's going to happen, one, or two, a good thing?
Yeah, it's really hard when you're faced with those because, like, they're wrong on both levels. You know what I mean? Like, on level number one, when it is a really easy market good, that pitch never comes true, right? Like, it's never in the workers' interest when the private sector comes in and is like, hey, we're going to take, you know, let's do like a good paying Teamster jobs in trucking. And they're like, we're going to deregulate this industry. And that's going to unleash, you know, all of this money that's going to go into working people's pockets. That's just not what happens. What goes away are the most stable, best paying jobs, and they're replaced with independent contractors who are paid starvation wages. And then you have what you see now, where you have, you know, UPS, fully unionized, Teamster-based company, and then this vampiric Amazon delivery service of low-wage workers just slowly but surely driving a truck from a career and a job that is good paying that you can build the life on into something where it's a scramble, right? It's a gig economy type thing. So even when it's a market good, we've seen over and over again that this promise of deregulation, privatization of public goods, that all of it is always a lie and it's just robbing working people for billionaires. But then add on that healthcare is not a market good like that, right? Like you can't, if you're in the middle of a heart attack or you just got into a terrible accident and you need to access healthcare, you can't act as a consumer and look for the best price, da-da-da-da-da.
You mean there's not an app for that? I can't, you know, while I'm having a heart attack, speed dial for the coupon of the day?
Right. And unfortunately, I mean, like you've seen the jokes about American healthcare, like that is people taking Ubers and it's the right thing to do, right? They're taking Ubers to the hospital because if you called an ambulance, it could bankrupt you or your family. Like our system was already really, really exploitative. And now it's just going to get worse. And yeah. I know we keep saying about the same thing, but I just want everyone to hear
absolutely
this one thing.
So last question I've got for you, because, you know, I'm looking at this map and I can't help but look at it. Clinton's legacy is NAFTA. Granted, it was birthed under Reagan, fully negotiated under H.W. Bush. Almost every Republican voted for it. Most Democrats didn't. But Clinton put his name on that pig. They tried to put lipstick on the pig by having some side labor and environmental regulations that were toothless. But ultimately, he's the one who bears responsibility. And the Democrats are the ones, messaging-wise, saddled for the horrible after effects of NAFTA. Do you see a future where working people, once we lose the healthcare industry in a lot of places, that this is the Republican future?
I hope that we're able to educate people well enough about who has done what to them, right? Like this is what they did. They took your hospitals, your nursing home, your healthcare away. The last part of the NAFTA analogy that's so spot on. What are they called when they, you know, they got rid of all these jobs, but then they put a little bit of money for retraining in?
The trade adjustment assistance.
Exactly, the trade adjustment assistance stuff, right? Like a Band-Aid on an amputation. They did that in the Big Ugly Bill because we were starting to break through on the hospitals of what a disaster it was. So they created a bucket of money that is a relief fund for the effects of their own bill, right? But it's like, yeah, if you take a hospital and remove, you know, it's a Band-Aid on an amputation, just like those policies under NAFTA were, it didn't work, right? It wasn't like these manufacturing jobs went away and then people retrained and then those areas of this country just flourished with a new identity, right? No, they died.
Yeah.
They died. They were devastated and they still are today.
Absolutely.
And that devastation will just continue with this assault on health.
No, and a lot of communities went from manufacturing over to a healthcare economy, and now they're going to have to go through it all again, all because we wanted to give tax cuts to billionaires. At the end of the day, all of this is about enriching the already wildly wealthy. And that to me is criminal. But Alex, I appreciate you taking some time, sharing your expertise on this. I wish this were better news, but we are where we are. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
Alex Lawson, Executive Director of Social Security Works. Check out the incredible work they do over at socialsecurityworks.org. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Concerned about the hospital in your neighborhood? Worried about maybe your job? Want to hear your thoughts? rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matinee on Air.
Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy, warm, and muggy tonight with a slight storm chance and a low in the low 70s. Heat advisory tomorrow, heat index approaching 100, a high around 90, a mix of sun and clouds, scattered storms. Storms still possible on Thursday. Currently at 77.
Doctors Without Borders is delivering life-saving medical care where it's needed most in communities around the world. From bandaging war-wounded patients in Sudan to providing clean drinking water in Haiti, we're in more than 70 countries worldwide, bringing patients from sick to recovering, from emergency to aid, from crisis to care. This life-saving care is made possible by a global movement of supporters like you. Thank you.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember, I think I brought this up a couple of weeks ago when Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana and Tim Scott of South Carolina introduced some bills that look a lot like what the building trades do without actually doing what the building trades do. What these bills look like they're doing is cementing independent contract gig work that you'll, in the future, no one will work for anybody. You'll be your own boss, but you'll be at the mercy of someone else. And I thought, interesting topic to get into because there's a legislative package here that if Republicans pack, you know, if they sell it right, could sound appealing to a lot of working folks. And here to share some thoughts on, well, just what these pieces of legislation are, I've asked Samantha Sanders to come talk with us. Samantha's the Director of Government Affairs and Advocacy there at the Economic Policy Institute. You can check out their website, epi.org. Samantha, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start right there. What is this? What have they done? What's the goal? What do you see out of these pieces of legislation by two Republican senators, very conservative Republican senators, whom I don't think have workers at their heart. But I'm curious, what do you see in this?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a great question to ask what the goal is, because I think there's the goal on paper, right? There's the goal in the messaging that's been released with these bills. And then there's maybe what the actual hidden goal is. So on paper, right, it sounds like a great thing. Portable benefits, the idea that if you are not in a traditional employer-employee relationship status, that you could have some reliable benefits that follow you from job to job between employers, and wanting to expand access for workers to have that. I think the goal behind the scenes, unfortunately, is it's important to keep in mind that not all portable benefits are created equal. And what these bills would do is incentivize further eroding that employer-employee status, shunting more workers into independent contractor classification where they have essentially shoddier second-tier benefits and rights, under the guise of making it look like the companies that are employing them or should be employing them are doing the right thing.
Right. Now, let's start right from the beginning of explaining what independent contractor status is. There's been a fight over the ABC test. There's been a fight over what some of this legislation will do, which will make it so much easier for companies to hire "quote unquote" independent contractors. So, what's the language in that right now, as you see it?
Yeah. So essentially, you know, employee status under the Fair Labor Standards Act, you know, is pretty broad. It always has been interpreted that way. Like the FLSA, that bill that gives most of us our kind of basic right to the minimum wage, to overtime pay, and other protections, you know, says that it is because we are suffered or permitted to work for an employer, right? And then you get certain rights with that status. What we've seen is that over time, over the last several decades, there has been a lot of, you know, fissuring. Some call it the fissured workplace, a term coined by David Weil. You know, it's just this idea that companies are trying to shed as many responsibilities and liabilities that they have toward workers as possible. So there's more of a move toward independent contractor status, which doesn't have those rights and protections. If you're an independent contractor, there's a such thing as a bona fide independent contractor, right? Which means you're in business for yourself. You have control over setting your rates of pay. You know, you kind of, you take on kind of running that independent business. However, there's a lot of people who are misclassified as independent contractors, which is where the employer actually does have a lot of control over you, but they're basically saying you're on your own for everything else. So if you're an independent contractor, you do not have the right to minimum wage. You do not have the right to overtime protections, and you lose out on other benefits. So independent contractors are more likely to be in kind of these more insecure, you know, jobs where they're not as, they don't have as reliable pay. They might not have access to health insurance, to retirement benefits, and so on. So I think these bills are kind of part of the continuum of companies, more and more companies, corporations trying to find ways to shed those responsibilities for workers, but still make it work. They want a little bit of the best of both worlds, right? So some of this messaging, you know, around these bills is like, oh, like companies really want to offer benefits to these independent contractors, but they just can't because then they would be classified as employees and it would blow up their whole business model. That's kind of the messaging behind these bills.
Yeah, if they wanted to offer them the benefits, they would just pay them more money so that they go out and buy them themselves, but they're never going to do that. And look, I've spent the last 35 years in the trucking industry where I watched firsthand as the industry was destroyed because of, hey, you want to be your own boss? Buy a truck. You're now Joe's Trucking. You're an independent contractor, but you got to wear the uniform, go where we tell you, when we tell you, how we tell you, but you're still your own boss. You're still your own guy, and we don't have to pay your health care, minimum wage, as you pointed out, or any of those other things that me as an employee would benefit from. And I've said, you know, the trucking industry is always kind of the canary in the coal mine. And if you want to see what the future of employment in this country is, take a look at the sweatshops on wheels that we got rolling up and down our highways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, to your point, I think sometimes these, you know, bills like these and others that are kind of talking about the rise of kind of alternative work arrangements or contingent work or the gig economy, you know, they're making people think of like folks who are doing work through a lot of these like digital app-based platforms, you know, your Ubers, your Lyfts, stuff like that. And those would absolutely be affected. But I think as you pointed out with trucking, there are plenty of other employers and types of industries that are way less sexy than the gig companies that have been doing these models for a long time and who would love to benefit from these kinds of changes, right? So there are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of talk in this messaging about this is about the 21st century workforce. People don't have need or want old fashioned work arrangements anymore. They want flexibility. And by flexibility, they mean employers want flexibility to not, you know, not give them what they're owed.
No, because look, if you want, if employers and workers wanted flexibility, there's a way to do that under the current model. It doesn't have to be, you know, 9 to 5. You can figure out new schedules. And this is where, you know, having a union protection, and the reason I brought up the building trades, because the building trades does this really well. Most of my building trades friends work for several different contractors across, you know, different employers, but their benefits, their health care, their pensions, their pay, their sick time, their vacation, all of that stuff is constant. These bills don't appear to do any of that stuff.
Yeah, I think that's right. And critically, they also don't come with the other protections that you would get if you're already in a union, right? And could benefit from, or, you know that you could rely on when you are between jobs or switching employers and stuff like that. And I think one of the key hooks into that is kind of one of the bills in particular from Senator Cassidy. What it does is it allows companies to offer these portable benefits in exchange for essentially a quote unquote safe harbor from claims of misclassification. As you've pointed out, some of these models are out there already. If you want to offer your, you know, if you want to set up systems where you can contribute to, you know, benefits for workers in alternative or different work arrangements, some of those models are out there. You could also give them employee status and give them those rights and benefits. Why do you need, if the employees are supposedly so happy and the benefits are so good, why do you need safe harbor from following the law? You know?
No, and this is the other part of this. All of these changes come with, oh, by the way, we're going to take your right to get some justice in the court system away. It's amazing how the people who tell us they believe in law and order, at this point with Trump in the White House, that's a joke, but I digress. But the people who tell us they're all about law and order seem to kind of want to keep us away from that and then move us into the world of, well, you can go and get arbitration, and not just voluntary, but forced arbitration, as we've seen, thanks to our Supreme Court, for every non-union worker in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, when you're thinking about what is the recourse that people are going to have for misclassification, if you are somebody who is in a job that's misclassified, I mean, again, coming back to thinking about who those workers are, some of the most commonly misclassified occupations, truckers, as you said, janitorial staff, like nursing and home health care aides, nail salon techs, right? Like, these are not folks who are making high wages and necessarily have time to track down or mount like a challenging legal defense or whatever anyway, right? And so it's just about kind of further empowering the people, further empowering the bosses, right, essentially in these situations to incentivize a second tier system for people who are already might be very economically insecure. And EPI has done some research on that, estimating that folks in these occupations, when they are classified as independent contractors versus employees, they lose up to thousands of dollars a year, right, in pay, compensation, the value of like the benefits, you know, that they could be getting if they had employee status.
And the other part of this, especially in the trucking industry and in the rideshare industry, is you take on all of the risk and the liability. Your truck breaks down, that guy's not coming to fix you. You got to figure out how to do it yourself. If your car breaks down, if you're in an accident, you know, whatever, your insurance, your tolls, all of that stuff, that's on you, brother. You're your own boss now.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is, I think, what we should be really cautious about when we hear, you know, folks like Senator Cassidy and Senator Scott talking about the 21st century workforce, right? They're like, it's all the worst parts of the modern economy and the 21st century workforce. For some reason, it's not usually like a nice vision of the future where we all have kind of secure employment with retirement and healthcare and, you know, good workers' compensation and reliable social security, which, by the way, is the ultimate portable benefit, right? It's all about kind of like, well, there's more and more people in the contingent workforce. We should just set up an alternative system or incentivize people toward that. But even the fact that there's a rise in people who are having non-traditional work, gig work, you know, more and more independent contractors, that's not a natural consequence or thing that happened, right? Like, that is a choice that employers made to shed those responsibilities and put people in those situations. So, you know, I think we really should be doing something about that, trying to address the overall root rather than saying like, well, people are in insecure work, let's give them insecure benefits as well.
No, and that's an excellent way to put this, because, you know, the question that I then came out with is, okay, Let's say this passes. Let's say that, you know, as an independent contractor, you now have access to, you know, a pooled employer plan or some other retirement pension system. Where's the money going to come from? Because most independent contractors I know are living hand to mouth. There's not a lot of money to be put in there. They could already be funding an IRA. So I'm in this spot where, is there any money coming along with this? Is there any, hey, employers, you got to kick in a percent? Is anything like that?
You know, I'm not positive off the top of my head. I think there have been portable benefits proposals before that have, you know, mandated that the employer in that situation would have to kick in a small amount, like a mandatory contribution, you know, of a few percent or something like that on behalf of the worker. But I think overall in the wash, that still comes out to less than they would be contributing if they had a real, you know, a solid plan and had to do kind of also like the other payroll contributions for other benefits and things like that. So it usually still stacks up as inadequate compared to, you know, what they'd be getting under employee status.
So is it safe for me to assume, because look, I haven't read all of the bills. I've read the summaries, but I'll tell you, when I see Cassidy's name, or I see especially Tim Scott's name on a piece of legislation that is purported to be benefiting working people, I got to tell you, I look at it with a jaundiced eye. So is there anything, do you see anything positive in this? Do you see my skepticism as rational? Any thoughts?
No, I think your skepticism is absolutely rational. And, you know, I don't have the fact sheet directly in front of me, but I think there have been past versions of kind of, you know, or other versions like in the House of things like the Modern Worker Empowerment Act and others. And a good sign is usually to look at who endorsed the bill and are there genuine, like bona fide worker organizations or unions who are in support of it? Or is it mostly employer organizations, representatives of the gig economy, you know, trucking companies rather than trucking workers, truckers themselves, you know, who are supporting some of these proposals. And that can usually be a good hint as to whether or not you should be skeptical of some legislation. So I think it's very warranted to be skeptical. But I'll say, you know, to your point, it's not just about Senator Cassidy and Senator Scott, who has an R by their name, right? There have been bipartisan proposals before, or others who have been kind of experimenting or flirting with, you know, this idea of portable benefits, of maybe we need some kind of in-between solution to deal with the problem, you know. And I think if you're going to take anything kind of good faith away from these proposals, it might be, okay, maybe there's some agreement that independent contractors are in a bad spot, right? That they don't have what they need to get by, that we need to do something about their situation. But I don't think that weakening their rights further is necessarily the right way. And I feel like one way you could look at that is like, maybe take out the safe harbor provisions, right? If there was like, why do the employers need a get out of jail free card on following current, you know, broadly accepted labor law?
No, that's an excellent point. But for me, I'm not against the idea of people starting their own business, putting their shingle out and doing the work. My problem is when that's really not your choice. You know, that's just how the industry has become. And I go back to trucking. Most truck drivers, you know, especially the long haul drivers, they're independent contractors. They got to be their own boss, and companies will bring them in, train them to be independent contractors. So it's not like you have the choice, because we're sold, and maybe you've got a thought on this. We're sold on the idea that as individuals, we have the choice in our particular industry to choose to be an independent contractor and run our own business or to work for someone else. And I would argue that you don't, in a lot of industries, have that choice. It's been made for you because the employers don't have to hire you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, kind of to your point with trucking, right? It's things like the whole business model might have changed such that there's only so many options available for workers. And I think that point you made about choice is really important here, because again, proponents of legislation like these bills or some other portable benefits proposals will come out, or really anything where particularly gig companies, because they have more and more of a kind of political presence, I would say, on the Hill in the last few years, but really all employers, you know, they will point to, well, workers really want flexibility, right? Our model clearly works because people are clamoring, people are signing up to do these jobs, right? They want to be able to choose their own schedules, you know, kind of be their own boss, not have all the we don't want to have all the trappings toward them as employers, and they don't want to have all the trappings of being an employee. But the truth is, right, if it's the difference between earning anything and not at all, right? Like, that's not really a true choice for a lot of workers. And there's been some research, you know, that my colleagues have looked at as well, that suggests that what workers really want when they say flexibility, you know, is that they want, you know, control over their schedules. Okay, that can happen with employee status. That could happen through fair scheduling policies and legislation, right? People want to be able to set their own rate of pay. If you're in a union and you're able to bargain, you know, what your wages should be, or you have that leverage with your employer, that's flexibility and choice, right? And I think what workers want is true flexibility. And what we've seen in some of the surveys and research about this is that they want also economic stability and security. They want guaranteed hours. Yep. They want guaranteed benefits. They want something to be there. They don't want their health insurance probably to be tied to their employer so that they can, you know, they have to stay with a toxic employer and not change jobs because they're afraid of losing their health care for their whole family or something like that, right? So I think there's a kind of perversion going on of what the word flexibility even means, right? It's like employers have their vision of flexibility, these gig companies and others have their vision. But, you know, I think it's important to think about what that really means for workers and what workers really want. It's probably true flexibility, not the flexibility to have absolutely no obligations from the people they're doing work for who are controlling their day to day.
No, absolutely. Most people, when they talk about flexibility that I know, it's, hey, I want to be able to go to my kid's baseball game. Hey, I want to make sure that I make a school event. Hey, I want to be able to take time if something comes up. That's the kind of flexibility that I hear people talking about. Not the kind where, hey, we've got all this work. You're going to work 100 hours this week and none next week. No, that's not, yeah. not the flexibility I think most people think of.
Yeah, all those options end up increasing flexibility for the employer, and the worker still ends up kind of being beholden to all those things like last minute schedule changes, trying to pack on more hours. If they're not entitled to minimum wage, like, is that really flexibility, or is that just saying you got to work longer for less? You know,
that's it. Absolutely. But Samantha, as all, I appreciate the work you guys do over at the Economic Policy Institute. Great stuff. Hope folks will check out the website, epi.org. Thanks so much for taking time and sharing some thoughts on this.
Thank you.
Samantha Sanders, EPI Director of Government Affairs. I want to hear your thoughts. You know any gig workers? You know any folks who think this might be a good idea? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. A group of labor leaders and members of the Working Men's Party met in St. Louis. They were there because of the labor strike that had swept the nation. The United States was in the grip of a terrible depression. Railroad workers in Martinsburg, West Virginia, had walked off the job after their wages were slashed. The popular uprising of workers spread to cities like Baltimore, Pittsburgh, and Chicago. Railroad tracks were ripped out of the ground. Workers rallied and protested, and workers from other industries joined the March of Labor. In St. Louis, the response of workers was even more radical. Many of the workers in the city were German immigrants. Some remembered the working class uprisings of 1848 in Germany. At the St. Louis meeting, they declared the start of the St. Louis Commune, a takeover of the city by working people. They called for the 8-hour day and the end of child labor. On both sides of the Mississippi River, both in St. Louis and East St. Louis, workers began a general strike. Railroad traffic was stopped. It was the first general strike in U.S. history. The workers had taken over St. Louis. 3,000 federal troops were amassed, along with thousands of gun thugs paid for by the railroad tycoons. The workers' rebellion was crushed. The strike committee was arrested, and at least 18 people were killed. Across the nation, 100 people lost their lives in the great upheaval of 1877. City leaders scrambled to build armories so they could quickly arm troops in case the workers rose up again. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I gotta tell you, I I'm not against the idea of portable benefits, and I've talked about this extensively over the years, where I actually think it's something Democrats should have been doing years ago, making sure that small businesses have an opportunity to have the same kind of benefits and all this stuff. And when the gig work started coming out, creating an environment much like the building trades has, much like the National Master Freight Agreement used to have when there were a hundred signatories to it. I'm a big fan of sectorial bargaining. I'm a big fan of industries having an overall contract that people work within. So wages, hours, conditions, all of that stuff are laid out. You want to work for five or six different contractors, you go right on ahead, kind of like the building trades folks do. And, so when I see these models being trotted out, I know they're trying to copy what the building trades do without actually doing what the building trades do. And it sounds appealing. Look, we're going to have, portable benefits. As long as you can find people to pay into them. So again, I've looked over these bills. I don't see any pay-fors. I see it as, well, you have access to it. I've got access to a lot of things. Doesn't mean I can afford it. And most working people, the reason that they haven't saved for retirement is they don't make enough money. And most gig employees that I know, they don't make enough money. The reason that they're drawn to it is because, it's a more flexible scheduling, but it's also lower pay. And look, I know a lot of rideshare people. If it weren't for the big tax dodge that comes with it, being able to write everything off, I don't know that you'd make a lot of money doing it. I don't know if you'd make any money doing it. But here again, what they've done masterfully is they've shifted the responsibility. In the old days, the cab companies had to fix the cabs. Took the risk. And then they figured out how to shift that responsibility. And this is what corporate America has done really well for decades. This isn't new. It's new now. It's the new now. And, again, I go back to where I started in the trucking industry. When I started, most people worked for a company. Most people had union protections. And since deregulation and Carter signed it, Democrats voted for it, but Republicans were right there all in. That destroyed that industry. But it opened it up so you could be your own boss. You could be an independent contractor. You could be your own boss, set your own schedule until you realize you got to pay the truck note, you got to pay the insurance, you got to pay the gas, the tolls, even the maintenance. And then you got to drive the truck. And for most people, they're living just to keep the wheels rolling. And I could tell thousands of stories from the years I had on the road. But I come back to one guy who told me he was home 5 days in a year and only took home about 16 grand after paying everything else. The truck made like 180,000. But by the time he paid his for the truck, the gas, the tolls, his living expenses, because living on the road ain't cheap, there wasn't much left over. And corporations know this. They would not be pushing in this direction if it didn't benefit them. And this is the weird part, because I know I'm going to get a lot of emails and a lot of response from people going, no, I love being a gig worker. I love being at will. I love, someone can call me on the phone and say, goodbye. Okay. Great. You should have the right to do that. As long as it fits into a scenario where you're actually independent. You're actually a contractor who controls your own workflow. Can do your thing, has autonomy in your work. But I look at a lot of my trucking buddies. I look at a lot of the people wearing that Amazon uniform and the FedEx costumes. Are they their own bosses? Especially when you're wearing someone else's clothes? But we're going to see. I look at, again, when Republicans slap their name on bills that are supposed to help workers, I check twice. Because there hasn't been anything in my lifetime that the Republican Party has done to help working people. Nothing. There has not been one piece of legislation at all that they've put forth to help working people solely. There's always been that pound of flesh to go to, well, the owner class. And I see this as more of that. So for me, when I see Cassidy's name, when I see Tim Scott's name on it, I'm thinking twice. I'd love to hear your thoughts, though. Tell me what you think. Do you think this could be helpful? If you're a gig employee, I especially want to hear from you. Happy? Or do you think you could make better wages, better benefits, better health care if your industry had more employees? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you will find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The number two person at the Justice Department, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, who also happens to be President Trump's former personal lawyer, says he'll meet with Jeffrey Epstein's incarcerated confidant.
The Deputy Attorney General says he plans to meet with Ghislaine Maxwell soon. In a statement, her attorney saying they are, quote, grateful to President Trump for his commitment to uncovering the truth in this case. And we should note she's appealed her 20-year sentence and is eager to get out of prison.
ABC's Mary Bruce. At a White House reception for congressional Republicans, President Trump announcing a new trade agreement. Japan will invest $550 billion in the U.S., which will get 90% of the profits. And Japan will pay reciprocal tariffs of 15%. Heavy metal pioneer Ozzy Osbourne has died. The rock star, diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2019, just finished a farewell tour reuniting with his Black Sabbath bandmates. Ozzy was 76. This is ABC News. A Pennsylvania woman.